Hey everybody, before we get into the show, I do want to let you know that we have another live show coming up Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. at Maya Cinemas in North Las Vegas. We are going to be talking about the vampire ballerina horror comedy Abigail. This movie looks like it's going to be a lot of fun. And joining me to talk about it are my wife, Gina Mazzoni, film student Perry Markle, and filmmaker and Sin City Horror Club founder Nick Woods. It's going to be a great time, great conversation. There's an enter to win contest going on right now on my website, piecingpod.com. You can find a link in the show notes. Enter to win some tickets. And otherwise, tickets are available from Maya Cinemas. And I hope to see you there on Thursday, April 18th at 6 p.m. Welcome to another episode of Piecing It Together, the podcast where we take a look at a new movie and try to figure out what movies inspired it. And today on the show is a little treat. We are covering a movie the day it comes out. We don't get to do that very often, but we are talking about Ari Aster's Midsommar, which came out today, July 3rd. And I'm excited to talk about it with film critic Josh Bell. And speaking of Josh Bell, our guest for the episode, he has a new podcast launching today that I produced that also is hosted by Jason Harris, who's been on the show a few times. It's called Awesome Movie Year, and you can find it anywhere that you listen to Piecing It Together. If you've been listening to the show lately, you know all about Awesome Movie Year, but just in case you haven't heard the last few episodes, the show is going to be like a deep dive into a different movie year each year, and they're going into different specific categories and filling each one in with a movie to talk about. For example, the first episode is the box office champ of the year 1994, which was The Lion King, so that's the episode that's up today. But we're going to also be talking about the first feature of a major filmmaker from 1994, the box office flop, a particular documentary, a foreign film, the best picture winner of the year, and a bunch of other great categories. So make sure you check out Awesome Movie Year, and we'd love to hear what you think about it. And we'd also love to hear what you think about Piecing It Together. So if you enjoy the show, why don't you go rate and review us on Apple Podcasts? That would be amazing. And make sure to subscribe while you're there. So I think we might as well get into this episode. Midsommar is a very, very much anticipated film. Hereditary is one of the best horror films of the last few years. Insanely assured debut from Ari Aster, that he just came out of the gate with this movie that was just so huge. It's pretty wild. And so, you know, all eyes are on him, much like with Jordan Peele earlier this year with us. We're wondering what was going to happen with his next movie. And now it's here. So make sure you've seen it, because we are, of course, going to get into some spoilers. And then let's jump into this conversation about Midsommar. All right, so today we are doing one that I know a lot of people are looking forward to. We are going to be talking about Ari Aster's Midsommar, and with me is Josh Bell. How's it going, Josh?
It's good. How are you?
Hey, man, I am all right. Lots of podcasting going on, but we took a break to go watch this the other day.
Yes, we did.
And it's going to be a fun one to talk about. It's a weird-ass movie, but I was really looking forward to it. I'm sure you were as well.
I was. I think I didn't like Hereditary, his previous film, as much as I had hoped to like it, or as much as a lot of people did. It was a movie that had so much hype behind it that I was really anticipating, and I like horror movies, and especially horror movies that are artistically ambitious, so I think I was hoping to like it a little more, but even so, I was definitely looking forward to this. He's obviously a very talented filmmaker with a unique vision. So I was excited, and I think it'll be fun to talk about.
Yeah, well, I think that we're gonna get into. I'll tell you right up at the front here. My puzzle piece list is a messy mess, but we will get into them the best we can. And I know you got a bunch too. I mean, this is a movie that clearly is inspired by a lot of different things.
Yes.
So you know what? Why don't we jump in? What do you got for your first puzzle piece?
Well, I'll start with something very obvious that I think has been cited in a lot of articles about this film, which is The Wicker Man.
Mm-hmm.
The original, let's say, I have to say I've never seen the Nicolas Cage remake, although that movie is infamous.
Yeah.
And I could see Ari Aster working with Nicolas Cage in the future. I think would be a fruitful team up.
Oh, boy.
But the original Wicker Man is a classic of, I guess you call it folk horror, I think is what Ari Aster has called this film.
Mm.
About the detective going to a small town in England to investigate, I believe it's like a missing woman.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, much like here, he kind of is embraced / creeped out by what's going on in this town. And something clearly is not right with the people who live there. And they're all building to this sort of pagan ritual at the end. And it turns out that he is part of it, whether he likes it or not.
Yeah.
and certainly that sense of the mix between like the charm of a small town or here the commune and the way that charm can just easily shift into creepiness and it's all kind of on the same spectrum. You've got that going and the way he's seduced by some of the residents of the town. Is something that we see here, but of course the seduction is all a tool of bringing in this outsider and getting part of the ritual. And the climax of The Wicker Man is famous. I think people remember those images even if they haven't seen the film. So,
right, yeah. It's kind of burned into the idea of like classic horror. I mean,
yes.
Yeah. And I'm not, that's one of those classics that I know it so well that I'm not even sure if I ever actually saw it. I just know the images, you know? And then, yeah, I mean, and then even to the Nicolas Cage remake, you know, you got the bear costume.
Right. And the bees.
Yeah. And the
there's
bees.
There's so many memes of that movie. I don't know if I could cite Wicker Man memes as an influence, but yeah. I'd like to see, I mean, even though it's notoriously terrible, I think I would like to see that Nicolas Cage film because people love how terrible it is.
Maybe it'll end up on Awesome Movie Year as a cult classic for...
Maybe. that would be a good candidate, definitely.
Yeah. Right on. Well, yeah, The Wicker Man, of course, is absolutely one that we should be talking about. And, you know, I think even back to the very first trailer for this, I mean, everybody was super excited to find out what Ari Aster was going to do next. And when this trailer came out, it was like, oh, wow, okay, he's doing The Wicker Man
now. Right.
And yeah, so I completely agree with that puzzle piece. Moving on to my first one, you know, you mentioned in that one about stuff that he had actually said himself, and one of the things he said leading up to the release of this film is he described it as, and I don't always like to use the director's own words when coming up with puzzle pieces, but I did think it was a piece worth mentioning. He described it as Alice in Wonderland for perverts. And
I thought it was it Wizard of Oz for perverts?
I thought it was Alice in Wonderland,
he said. It could be both, or neither. I don't know, but go for it.
Either way, okay, let's say Alice in Wonderland and Wizard of Oz, combine them into one puzzle piece. But yeah, it's just this journey into this weirdness and just all kinds of colorful characters and set pieces and just so much weirdness, but of course taken to a very, very hard R rated place. You know, it's almost shocking that they got the R rating, to be honest, with some of the imagery that they were able to get away with this thing. But but yeah, I mean, it does take that kind of Wonderland you know, imagery and just take it to really dark and disturbing places, which I think that quote, which maybe I'm getting it wrong, but
I don't know. We'll have to look it up.
That quote,
I might remember it wrong.
Yeah, it definitely does describe it properly, whichever movie it was.
Yeah, yeah. No, no, I agree. And it has that sort of like, I mean, in both of those movies, it's about a young woman getting caught up in this fantastical world where she encounters inexplicable dangers, let's say. And of course, those stories are a little more family friendly. Sure. Although I think of, I don't know if you've ever seen Jan Svankmajer's version of Alice in Wonderland, which I think is just called Alice, the Czech director who does all of these weird,
disturbing
stop motion animation.
Yeah.
And I, you know, I hadn't had this down, but now that I'm thinking about it, I feel like Jan Svankmajer is probably an influence here as well. I've seen that Alice in Wonderland and Little Otik, I think, is the one other of his films that I've seen. And he also maybe made a movie about an insane asylum that I saw at a film festival. I'm trying to remember, but they all have that sort of like nightmarish, can we ever wake up from this dream quality to them.
Yeah. And the drugs certainly add to that.
Oh, and the drugs. Yes.
Nice. What do you got for your next puzzle piece?
Well, I guess I'll continue with obviousness for the moment and mention Hereditary.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, not only because this is, of course, the same filmmaker, but I feel like there's a lot of similar themes here about family trauma and how you deal with that. I mean, Hereditary opens with Toni Collette having to speak at her mother's funeral, and the legacy of her dead mother is really what drives the whole story in that movie, and sort of the way that the mother is controlling or influencing things kind of from beyond the grave.
Yeah.
And this movie is not quite the same, but it of course opens with Danny, Florence Pugh's character, dealing also with a family tragedy, a much more horrific one, this murder-suicide, and that also hangs over her head as she goes forward. And it's not necessarily a direct influence on what happens later, but it is an important influence on her
as a
character and how she reacts to things going forward. So I think there's a lot of similar themes here. Blunt force trauma to the head.
He does seem to like his blunt force.
I mean, of course he's influenced by his own work, but I definitely saw some parallels.
I think when we were walking out of the theater, I said that like the last 2 hours of the movie reminded me of the last 15 minutes of Hereditary, like just stretched out for a couple hours. But yeah, absolutely, dealing with similar themes, but then just kind of extending the craziness factor, I think, for a long time and like trying to ride that. I also think, and I mean, it's very kind of shallow to say, but I think that comparisons between Toni Collette's performance and Florence Pugh's performance are going to be made all year long. You know, it's kind of inescapable. And I'm not going to comment necessarily on which is a better performance or if there's a better performance, but certainly I think that they're comparable in a lot of ways.
Yeah. I mean, I think Toni Collette in Hereditary is a much bigger performance. I mean, she gets builds the like hysteria throughout that movie. And Florence Pugh in this movie is much more subdued and internal. And a lot of the like, reactions that she has or the plans that she makes, you can see are all kind of churning in her mind, and she's not going big. But I think they're both very, very good performances. I like Florence Pugh a lot. I'm glad that she's getting more success. I saw her in a movie called Lady Macbeth a couple years ago. I don't know if you saw that, but
never did.
She is fantastic in that movie, which is super dark, and she just plays this nasty, awful character who is fascinating to watch. But yeah, she's, I mean, even in like Fighting With My Family, where she's like doing this feel good pro wrestling thing, she's a very charismatic actor, and I'm glad to see her getting more attention.
Yeah, that's awesome. I'm looking forward to seeing her in more. I mean, she's fantastic in this. All right, I'm going to go with another, you know, we're sticking with these obvious ones. I'm going to go with one more obvious one here. Well, maybe a few more will be.
Yeah.
But this next one is Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, a movie I've brought up multiple times on the show, but not just the drug stuff. But
not just the drug stuff.
Not just the drug stuff, but tied to the drug stuff, the actor's specific performances of reacting to their surroundings while on drugs. You know, it's not just trippy imagery. It's the performances and the reaction shots. I mean, some of the reactions, the faces on these actors, I found almost like more horrifying than the stuff that was actually happening, you know, more so than that blunt force trauma to the head or the person jumping off the ledge or, you know, any of that stuff is just their faces. And I remember in Fear and Loathing, I mean, there's a lot of like, I mean, they're just freaking the fuck out, you know? And so it's like, it just kind of reminded me of that, that really, you know, I guess realistic portrayal of just tripping balls. You know
what I mean? Right. yeah, that's, I mean, you said it was obvious, but that's not some one that I would have thought of.
Yeah.
But that's, yeah, that's true. That, I mean, I can't speak to the realism of it.
Sure.
But yeah, the way they react. And I feel like also it's easy movies where they want to tell you that the characters are freaking out on drugs.
Yeah.
It's easy to go way too far with that.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think this movie, I mean, this is not a subtle movie.
No.
But the way it depicts the characters being on drugs isn't too crazy over the top. It gives you the sense that like there's definitely some weirdness happening and they're maybe freaking out internally.
Yeah.
But it's not like, you know, pink elephants marching across the street or something like that.
Yeah, and they don't go to like Dude Where's My Car territory of like, whoa, you know.
Right.
Oh. And who knew I'd be bringing up Dude Where's My Car during a Midsummer episode.
Yes. That's great. I want to see Ari Aster's take on the stoner comedy.
Ooh.
That would be something.
I'm in.
Yes.
I'm in 100%. What do you got for your next puzzle piece?
Okay. So, well, I will admit that you said you grabbed that one quote from him, and I totally read an IndieWire article that was like, Ari Aster tells us 10 of his influences.
I saw that article, yes.
And if you resisted, you're a better man than I am. So I may quote a couple from there, but I will say I only picked out ones from there that were, you know, that I had been kind of thinking about and are movies that I'm familiar with. So to start with, one that he did mention in that article is Lars von Trier's Dogville. Mm. And I think Lars von Trier in general is a big influence on this movie.
Right.
And there's so many von Trier movies that are about these female protagonists who are just like pounded by life and by the horrible men around them.
Yeah.
And that finally either snap in a sort of pathetic way, or in the case of Dogville, in a very vengeful way.
Yeah.
And I think you can definitely draw a parallel between Nicole Kidman's character in Dogville, who is this vulnerable woman who comes to this small, isolated community and is hoping to be embraced, and eventually takes her revenge, let's say.
Mm-hmm.
And in Midsummer, I mean, she doesn't end up taking her revenge on the community. She becomes sort of like the queen of the community, I guess we could say, to spoil the ending there. So that's okay, right? We can do that.
Sure,
yeah.
Absolutely.
So, but I mean, I think it's similar where like for all of this time, she's being like battered about by all the people in her life. I mean, especially the dudes from the US that she already knows, but even the people in the village, it's not always clear whether they're like trying to embrace her or they're going to murder her.
Right. Or even just fucking with her.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. They seem to be taking some pleasure in screwing with her and with all of these outsiders and slowly revealing their real intentions. But you know, I think it's a movie that by beating her down, it kind of builds her up until that very final shot where you're like, oh, she's now exactly in control and where she wants to be.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah. And I think also the like almost punishing aspect of the movie, even on the audience, is something that Lars von Trier is all about, more so than Ari Aster.
That's actually an interesting point because, you know, I was just thinking about this morning while I was finalizing my notes here. I'm still wondering how audiences are going to take this movie, you know?
Yeah.
At the time of our recording, it hasn't come out yet. And, you know, audiences seem to not really like Hereditary, despite the fact that, you know, critics and, you know, film nerds loved it so much. And I wonder if this is going to be like doubling that down, you know?
Yeah, I think possibly. I mean, weirdly enough, this is a movie that, from a plot standpoint, is not that weird.
Yeah.
Is really pretty straightforward.
Yeah.
Again, if you've seen The Wicker Man, you have a really good idea of what the plot of this movie is.
Yeah.
And interestingly enough, this isn't even a movie where he originated the idea. Like, he was hired to make a movie that was like a folk horror movie set in Sweden.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like almost a work for hire thing. And yet he brings so much of his style and his vision to it that I think you're right that audiences are going to probably not know what the heck to do with this movie, especially I think, you know, we've had horror movie after horror movie and people who went to see Annabelle Comes Home the week before and Child's Play the week before that and are like, oh, here's the new cool horror movie, are going to just hate this thing so much.
Well, you know what? That's a good setup for my next puzzle piece.
All right.
Whenever a movie builds and builds and builds that craziness since the start of this podcast, I always have to bring up a movie you know I love so much, and that is Mother. Another yes. movie people absolutely hated and have no idea what to do with. But yeah, no, it's just, you know, that build of just constant, you know, it getting crazier and crazier and crazier as it goes and as it builds to a finale that's just kind of... If you're along for the ride, you know, it works really well, and it's like, it's pretty awesome and awe-inspiring, but I imagine that if you're not along for the ride, it's like, you know, all right, fuck this movie, I'm done with this shit.
I can see this movie, like, we saw it at a screening just with other media members, but I could imagine going to, a regular public screening and just seeing a stream of walkouts.
Yeah, walkout after walkout, absolutely. Yeah. And I think that Ari Aster relishes in that, you know, quite a bit. Like you said, with the Von Trier example, I think he loves that quite a bit, you know?
Yeah, and I'm all for that. You know, a movie that can be very polarizing like that. But yeah, I think like Mother, if they do a cinema score polling on this, I think this movie could very well get an F.
Yeah.
Which usually means not necessarily the movie is bad, but just that there's a real disconnect between what people thought they were going to get out of it and what they actually did. And they're mad about that.
Yeah.
So I could be wrong, but it would not at all surprise me to see this get a cinema score F the week that it opens.
One of my girlfriend's friends asked me on Facebook if this was more like Hereditary or like Mother. And I said, probably more like Mother. And she was like, oh, I'm not seeing it.
I don't know. I mean, I think Mother is a lot more abstract than this movie. Uh-huh. You know, again, from a basic plot standpoint, this movie is very easy to follow.
Sure.
I can see those similarities. And like you, I really like Mother.
Sure.
I maybe not quite as much as you do, but I thought it was very good. I think I had it on my top 10 list for the year. And I really have a lot of respect for Darren Aronofsky just doing whatever the hell he wants, like Ari Aster.
Absolutely.
And managing to find people to finance it still.
Yes, yes. Movies are getting made, right. I always say it.
Yes, yes, they are. We'll see how long it works for Ari Aster as well. Because obviously A24 was eager. They hired him to make this movie.
Yeah.
That had someone, I don't know, some executive or somebody had come up with the idea.
Yeah.
But if this movie tanks, which it's totally going to tank.
Yeah.
how many more times will he get a bunch of money to make movies? I hope a lot, but we'll see.
Yeah. We will see. What do you got for your next one?
So speaking of movies that people hated, another movie that I really like that was marketed as the next big horror thing, and I think people went in and just did not like at all, is The Witch, Robert Eggers' film.
Mm-hmm.
And beyond that sort of marketing standpoint, I think going back to what I was saying about Dogville, this is a movie where for much of the running time, you think it's about this female protagonist, Anya Taylor-Joy's character, being kind of beaten down and being the victim of the people around her who are oppressing her, mainly dudes, as well as these outside supernatural forces. And by the time you get to the end of the movie, you discover that she's the one now in control and she's sort of doling out the punishment to the people who have tormented her. And I thought the way the journey of Danny, the main character in Midsommar, was very similar, and especially the ending of this movie really recalls the ending of The Witch, where she's now taken on that power for herself.
Sure. You know, I want to make two points about that, because I think I didn't write The Witch down, but it's such a great puzzle piece. The first one I want to mention a little more seriously is that the set design, The Witch is just so impeccably designed, you know, and it's, you know, even though, of course, it's a very different style of design, I mean, it's just that attention to detail is just fantastic.
Yeah, the set
movie.
Design in Midsommar is just like astonishing to me.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. The other one, a little bit more jokey, but when they first arrived in the village, and this is one of my biggest disappointments of the movie, is I thought the dog was going to have a bigger role.
Oh, see, I didn't even remember there being a dog.
There was a dog running and barking when they first got to the village. Okay, and I was like, I can't wait to see what happens. There's some weird A24 dogs. I mean, there was It Comes at Night dog and what was the other one? But I thought maybe it would get a Black Phillip level characterization or something,
Or even the bear.
Yeah.
You know,
the bear could have gotten a little more.
Yeah. Yeah. That poor bear doesn't do anything. It just kind of shows up so that we remember that it's there for the climax.
Yeah. And a good joke, too. So,
yes. Yeah.
Anybody going to mention that bear? The witch, great, great puzzle piece. And a good setup for my next puzzle piece. This is the first one that I thought of while I was sitting there in the theater. And that is, it's not one particular movie, but it is the films of Wes Anderson.
Okay.
This, the design of the shots in this movie are just so, just perfectly set up, and every frame is just filled to the brim, and there's like, you know, things are in every corner of every shot, or everything is, symmetrical, and you know, all that kind of thing, the kind of thing that Wes Anderson is very much known for. And I mean, of course, he's taking those ideas from, you know, filmmakers that have come before him, but I mean, his films though are the ones that I've seen, first of all, but also I think are very well known for doing that. And I think that Ari Aster is kind of doing almost like a horror version of that kind of an idea.
Yeah, I am not a big Wes Anderson fan. I mean,
as I know,
I'm definitely anti Wes Anderson. But I can see what you're saying, and I think I can't remember what episode it was, but I'll bring up, like I did whenever it was we last talked about Wes Anderson, the Midnight Coterie of Sinister Intruders, the SNL sketch featuring, which is the Wes Anderson horror movie.
Yeah, that's right.
Which I love. I like far more than any actual Wes Anderson movie.
Uh-huh.
But I can definitely see that in that kind of attention to detail, especially in the set design. I was amazed. At one point in the movie, I was like, this must be just some real village that they found. There's no way that they built all this stuff.
Right, right.
But they did. They didn't even shoot this movie in Sweden. They shot it in Hungary, apparently.
Wow.
And just all of the paintings or drawings on the walls.
Every single little detail. There's so much in it. So much to look at.
Yeah. It's amazing. But yeah, I've seen a couple articles also cite Stanley Kubrick in terms of the like control of the images.
Sure.
And the very meticulous way that they're composed. So,
I could see that. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
All right. What do you got for your next puzzle piece?
All right. Well, going back to something that Ari Aster said, he cited Ingmar Bergman as a big influence, and his main example was Scenes from a Marriage, which I haven't seen, but which is a drama about a couple breaking up, which you can definitely see here. But I'll mention The Seventh Seal, which is probably the most well-known Bergman film, and also one of the only ones that I've seen. But that dreamlike quality and the pagan rituals, that austereness to the images, all of that is all very much Bergman-esque, and The Seventh Seal is all about those. The rituals and the sort of folk religion. I think for me watching this movie, I thought of that. And maybe if I had seen Scenes from a Marriage or had seen a wider range of Bergman movies, I might think of some other ones. But
yeah,
of course, Bergman is Swedish, and that makes sense that this movie is not only set in Sweden, but influenced by Swedish and Scandinavian films. And of course, for me personally, I can't think of The Seventh Seal without thinking of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey when they play chess with death, which of course comes initially from Max von Sydow in The Seventh Seal. But Bill and Ted, not a puzzle piece for Midsummer.
Oh, how I wish it was. Yeah, no, I've never seen The Seventh Seal. I do think it's interesting though, as I'm like going over the puzzle pieces I've spoken about so far and what I've got coming up, I don't have any related to the relationship, which is actually one of the most interesting things about the movie.
Yeah.
Even though it's only the focus for the beginning and the setup, and it kind of takes a backseat once we actually get to the village. I mean, it's still very interesting and well done, I thought.
Yeah, and I think it's a theme, even though maybe it takes a backseat, it's something that's always on the movie's mind and you always think of when those two main characters are interacting, when Danny and Christian are interacting. And I think her actions are motivated as much by the relationship and his treatment of her as they are by the like family trauma that she experiences at the beginning of the movie.
Sure, sure. Well, I'm going to go with another puzzle piece. And This next one is a very popular movie called Get Out.
Oh yeah.
So I just thought of the coming into this world that like they just seem like such nice people, with such good intentions.
Right.
But there's just that something that you know from the get-go, regardless of having seen a trailer or anything like that. You just know watching that, like, there's just no way that it's going to be as straightforward as it certainly seems, and as nice and sweet as they certainly seem. And you just know it's just going to go in horrible, horrible directions.
Yes.
So, yeah, both movies have that same kind of a feel. And also, the slowly, learning about their customs and the things that they're into and the things that they do and all the behind the scenes. And like, it's like the way that it's slowly doled out over the course of the movie.
Yeah. And they're also very white.
They're very white. Yes.
I can definitely see that. And I thought it was interesting. Like, when the movie started, I figured, well, they got to do something related to the fact that there's one black dude in this movie.
Yeah.
And is, he's like the only black person in Sweden at the moment, practically. And it really never comes up.
No, it doesn't.
It's not something that they mention or that there's even any indication that he feels extra discomfort because of this. And I don't know from a casting standpoint, like, was the character written that way or did it just come up because they cast that actor, William Jackson Harper,
mm-hmm.
who's great on The Good Place, if you ever watch that show. He's very funny, very different kind of character. So I was kind of waiting for something about that to come up, and it never really did.
Yeah, that is interesting. And I almost wonder if they cast it making you, it's just another question that's going to be in the back of your mind as you're going through the movie. Like, there's got to be something with this guy. what I mean? But then it never comes. Just constantly keeping you on edge or thinking about various different things.
Right. That's true. It definitely was an added thing to put you on edge, to put me on edge, just because I was kind of expecting.
Sure.
And maybe also playing a little bit with the horror cliches of who dies first or something like that. Or oftentimes, especially in Get Out, they do a lot with this with Lil Rel Howery's character, where he's the one who's like, come on, this is not the place that you should be going.
Yeah.
And I think that's maybe what we expect from the black character. Whereas in this movie, he's the one who's the most enthused about being there because he's trying to study their rituals. And he's, even when we have the horrifying old people jumping off a cliff, he's like, no, hey, that's normal. That's what they do here. It's fascinating.
It's interesting. It's fascinating.
Right.
That's actually a good point because I did write down, it's not a piece or anything. It's just a note I had written down, is that the movie just seems so self-aware of being a horror movie, and like it mines a lot of comedy out of that. And so it does make you think that he probably is thinking about that while he's writing this movie.
Right. Yeah. The line when they're like, oh, the children are watching Austin Powers.
Yeah.
That was a great insert because all of a sudden you're like, Austin Powers exists in the world of this movie. These people just watch some stupid Mike Myers comedy. What the hell is that? But sadly we never got to see them watching Austin Powers.
That would have been a good payoff.
And how they appreciated it or not.
That could have been a post credits.
Yes.
All right, what do you got for your next puzzle piece?
Well, I'm going to move something up because you had mentioned the relationship and whether you're not having something. And a movie that I thought of specifically related to that is a movie from a few years ago called The Loneliest Planet by Julia Lochtev, which got a lot of critical attention at the time. Features Gael Garcia Bernal and some other people who I'm less familiar with. But this is a movie about a couple going on a trip to rural Europe. I think it's Georgia, actually, the former Soviet Republic. And they're going on this hike through the mountains led by this local guide. And so it's an extremely slow movie. And it's one of these movies where the whole time you're watching it, the characters are just doing these mundane things and you're like, oh, something bad is going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And you just wait and wait and wait. But it's all related to their relationship, the obviously not great relationship between these two main characters.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere around, it's been a little while since I saw it, but around the midpoint or maybe even later than the midpoint of the movie, there's a moment where they're being threatened potentially by somebody with a gun and they're in a foreign country, they don't speak the language, they don't know what's going on, and they fear for their lives. And in that moment, the dude, Gael Garcia Bernal, it like basically pushes the woman in front of him, like is ready to sacrifice her. He's like George Costanza running out from the fire. And that moment just kind of crystallizes what their relationship really is. And I think in this movie, Christian is not specifically sacrificing Danny. I mean, if anything, it's the other way around, but he definitely seems like the kind of dude who would do that.
Sure. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, that was a movie, The Loneliest Planet, where it was highly critically acclaimed, and I kind of felt a little underwhelmed with it, but I think it has a lot of similar themes.
Right on. Yeah, no, I never did see it, but yeah, those themes you were just talking about, they make total sense. All right, well, my next puzzle piece is the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Oh, good one, yes.
I just think that this movie, you know, I'm not specifically commenting on the effectiveness necessarily, but on certainly the intention is just this pure terror, unescapable terror, you know what I mean? And yeah, Texas Chainsaw Massacre is just such a perfect version of that feeling. And this is a movie that, in a different setting, with different specific goals, story-wise and character-wise, but is still taking you into this inescapable place and where just awful things are going to happen. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, that's a good example. And I think another one where they're in the middle of nowhere and they stumble upon this place, and at first it seems like, oh, good, someone will help us.
Yeah.
And clearly that is not what happens.
Oh, yeah. And I, of course, could have pointed to a lot of other movies that use that kind of setup, but right. I mean, that just seemed like a good one to go to.
Yeah, no, that is a great movie, of course. I love the Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Is amazing. And a movie that you watch now and you're like, how did this become like a cultural phenomenon? Because it is also like weird and off-putting and unpleasant to watch in a lot of ways.
A little slow too. By today's standards anyway.
Right. Yeah. But it's a great movie.
Absolutely.
So I'll go back a little to Ari Aster's own list of things and mention Powell and Pressburger's Black Narcissus, which I think he mentioned a couple of Powell and Pressburger movies, including stuff that I hadn't seen. So but I was thinking about Black Narcissus because I saw kind of in the lead up to this article, it mentioned The Red Shoes, which is another Powell Pressburger movie that I have not seen. And that made me think, no, not that one, but Black Narcissus, which is a movie about this isolated convent in, I want to say in like the Himalayas, where these nuns live and work. And there's a young nun who comes to this convent as one of her first assignments, and she's kind of naive. And over the course of the movie, she just loses it. And I mean, it's not a horror movie. It's more of a tragedy and a melodrama. But it also is incredibly beautifully composed. The Technicolor they use, I mean, and that's something that Powell and Pressburger are known for, is the gorgeous composition in their films. But it is a movie that draws you into this isolated world and gives you a sense of it in order to see how things kind of break down in that world. So, it doesn't surprise me that he's influenced by them in general. And specifically that movie. And I saw that movie on Nitrate Film at the Turner Classic Movies Film Festival, which was a great way to see a movie like that. And it just, the colors are just, they like leap out at you. And this movie has great use of color as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely. I've never seen Black Narcissus, but it sounds really cool. I mean, the way you describe
it. Yeah, it's a great, I mean, it's a classic.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a great movie. And Powell and Pressburger in general are landmark directors who I have not seen enough of their films.
Right on. Well, you know what? I have not read the article you're describing.
That I've cheated from?
Yes. I saw it and I have it saved for later, but I didn't want to read it.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah, that was smart.
However, I did see his tweet reply, one of many tweet replies to the article.
Oh, okay.
And this is a first for the show. It is a director ahead of my recording of the episode debunking a puzzle piece I was going to mention.
Okay.
But it is, and of course, this is also a movie that's probably too new to truly be an influence, but I was still going to mention it anyway, and that is Climax from Gaspar Noé.
Oh, which I know you love.
I did love Climax, and he said in his reply, no, I was not influenced by Climax, but it is a swell movie. I think that, first of all, aside from the fact that these are both, you know, purely insane movies, they do share a lot. There's a lot of dancing and creepy dancing. Yes. There's a lot of tripping off drugs. The characters are all trapped and have no escape and just have to deal with their surroundings and their situation.
Yeah.
There are a lot of things that I think tie the two movies together. And, you know, obviously he straight up said he's not influenced by it, but I think that probably a lot of the same influences probably influenced him as, you know, as well as Gaspar Noé in the making of Climax.
Right. Yeah. I did see that was in that article. Mm-hmm. I still have not seen Climax.
Yeah.
So I did not mention it myself, and I don't know that I read all the specific details, but just because he wasn't specifically thinking of that movie while he was working doesn't mean that it's not, doesn't share similar qualities.
Absolutely.
So maybe you can have Ari Aster on this show.
And, there we go. And,
or you could just read that whole article into the microphone for a podcast episode. Quote him extensively. I'm going to go back to one of my non-cheat picks and mention a movie. This is also a recent, not as recent as Climax, but from probably 2 years ago or something, a movie called The Endless by Benson and Moorhead, who are kind of indie sci-fi horror directors, you could say.
Mm-hmm.
And this is a movie about a pair of brothers who have escaped or just kind of left this commune, which is totally a cult. and it has very similar qualities. I mean, it just like is in California in like the mountains somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But it's about these brothers who they've left this cult where they grew up, and they've tried to forge new lives for themselves out in the real world. And it's really not working out very well for them. And they decide to go back for a visit to the cult and end up staying, and all sorts of crazy shit happens.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a science fiction movie. So it definitely gets further into the realm of that stuff than certainly Midsommar does.
Yeah.
But I think it has a lot of similarities in the way that when they first show up at the cult, and their relationship to it obviously is different in mm-hmm. that they left and they kind of rejected it. But at the same time, the people seem so nice and friendly. And instead of saying, where the hell have you been? And why did you leave us? And we're going to punish you. They're just, oh, it's so great to see you. What's been going on? Thanks so much for visiting.
So friendly.
You know, everybody seems so nice. And over the course of the movie, one of the brothers kind of decides, you know what? We should just stay, while the other brother is trying to remind him there are reasons that we left in the first place. And that kind of tension between the two of them is what drives the movie until they discover like alternate dimensions and stuff, which is outside the scope of Midsommar. But that dynamic of the cult that just seems like a bunch of really friendly people, and like, why would you even call them a cult? They're just these nice folks.
Right.
I think really comes up in that movie.
Nice. I've never seen The Endless, but absolutely. I mean, this is, you know, this is a straight up cult, weird cult movie.
Yes, in every way.
So I mean, it's pretty perfect. So I only have one more puzzle piece, and it is as we call them, a bucket of movies.
Yes.
And that is just like cannibal movies in general. You know, I wasn't really gonna point to any specific fairly recently it was The Green Inferno, Cannibal Holocaust, you know, the various cannibal related movies where, you know, it's just a village of crazy, murderous people, you know? And while, like we were saying, they're so nice at first. And then in this one, you know, that things eventually go to everybody being just, you know, insane. You
yes.
know? Yeah.
So that's interesting to me, because I wonder, there's a certain scene in this movie where I thought, oh, it's cannibalism.
Right. I know
and
you
then
mean.
Later on, I thought, maybe it wasn't.
Right. Yeah, it's
hard to
say. What
are your thoughts on that?
It is a good question, because, Yeah, I don't know if it was, because even with that puzzle piece, I'm not specifically saying they are cannibals. I'm saying that, like, the vibe of just being murdered by the village people,
right.
You know?
Yeah, they got a cannibal thing going on.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah, I mean, certainly it is suggested that they might be, you know? But that's the thing about this movie, though, is... many, many, many questions are not answered. Like, yeah. You know, we're really in the dark as to what exactly is going on in that village. I mean, there are some things that are, you know, fairly clear about, like, their lifeline and all that kind of stuff. But as to the reasons they're doing some of these things, not everything is explained. And it just keeps you so creepily in the dark.
Yeah, yeah, I agree. That is part of the effectiveness of this movie, that just like the characters, we don't really understand the motivations or what these people are doing. But yeah, that one particular scene, I think even if it's ultimately not meant to be cannibalism, I think it's very deliberately setting you up to think that it is.
Sure.
And then maybe giving you a bit of doubt so you don't really know.
It's part of that self-awareness of the movie, which I think is something that he set out to do, is to really just play with you the whole way through as to what exactly it is you're watching.
Right. Yeah. 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 So I only have two more.
Okay.
And one is, I think to kind of, that goes along with what we're just talking about the cannibal movies and the cult movies. And that is Ty West's, The Sacrament, which is, a found footage movie, that is partially inspired by the Jonestown Massacre. And the plot there is that, this guy and his friends are headed off to this very friendly seeming commune where his sister has been living, and she's sending him letters about how great it is and you should come visit. It's so beautiful and wonderful. And they show up, and his friends are kind of making a documentary. I think they're actually supposed to work for Vice in the movie. I think they actually specifically use that.
Wow.
And so, of course, they show up and everyone seems super friendly and like, everything is great, and look at how this is working out so well, and what if we could even stay? And then the murder begins. Because it's inspired by Jonestown, you really know what's going to happen.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
It's not a historical, it takes place in the present day. It's from 3-4 years ago. But it follows in kind of broad strokes what happened there. And there's a great performance. And I, of course, now I've forgotten the actor's name, but the guy who plays the cult leader is just so frighteningly charismatic. And he gives this long speech at one point, like towards the climax of the movie, that's just mesmerizing. And you really see where, like, he's clearly a monster, but also you understand why people are all following him. And there's some speeches in this movie. They're not quite at that level. They're a little more subdued, but you can see how the leaders of this cult have drawn everyone in and are holding them in line and whatever.
That's another interesting thing about this movie, I think, is that there's not a set leader. It doesn't seem like there's, like, it seems like everybody is a leader of this thing.
Yeah. I've seen a couple of reviews that cite this as like a matriarchal cult, but I didn't necessarily get that. There's definitely at least one woman who seems like she's a main leader, but there's also a man who seems like he's really a main leader, and he's the keeper of that weird library of books written by mentally disabled people. I think either of them could have been the person who you think, oh, this is the leader of the commune.
Yeah.
So, all right. And then the last thing I'll mention is another one from the article that Ari Aster was talking about. And I think it goes along with your mention of Wes Anderson. And that is Roy Anderson's Songs from the Second Floor. And Roy Anderson films in general. He's another Swedish filmmaker. And if you think Wes Anderson has a carefully composed, symmetrical, fussy compositions, man, you have not seen anything until you watch a Roy Anderson movie. I think maybe all of his movies or many of his movies, and Songs from the Second Floor is the most famous, is just a series of fixed camera point set pieces.
Yeah.
So every scene has a fixed camera, is a single take, and the camera, it may move, but it stays on a fixed point and kind of rotates.
Mm.
And everything in the frame is clearly just, it's been built from the ground up, and he has put it exactly in the place that it needs to be to film this. And it's not horror really, although there's some unsettling stuff in his movies. It's more deadpan comedy, but there's, as we were saying, there's moments of deadpan comedy in this movie. Absolutely.
Absolutely. Yeah, I gotta see that because I do. I mean, I know you don't like Wes Anderson, but I do. I like that when there's that kind of like weird attention to detail.
Yeah, I mean, I liked Songs from the Second Floor. I've seen that and one or two others of his films. And I think because that was the most famous, if not necessarily the first one, you watch that movie and you're like, wow, this is such a unique vision. And then you watch two more and you're like, oh, so this is just what he does. And it kind of loses its power a little bit.
I love you, Wes Anderson. Don't listen to Josh.
I'm talking about Roy Anderson. I'm talking about Roy Anderson here. Okay. But yeah, Wes Anderson, yeah, I never grabbed me. Sorry.
Well, let's do the finish puzzle and then we'll get to our final thoughts on Midsommar. The finish puzzle includes The Wicker Man, Alice in Wonderland, or Wizard of Oz. We got to fact check that. Hereditary, Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, Dogville, Mother, The Witch, the films of Wes Anderson, The Seventh Seal, Get Out, The Loneliest Planet, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Black Narcissus, Climax, The Endless, Cannibal Movies, The Sacrament, and Songs from the Second Floor. So, Josh, got any closing thoughts about Midsommar?
I mean, I liked it. I think I liked it more than Hereditary. As I was saying at the beginning, I was a little disappointed in that, and maybe because my expectations here were a little lower, I liked this movie more than that. I feel like even though it is off-putting and weird and a lot of people will probably hate it, I think it is actually a pretty straightforward horror movie. And I thought it worked well in that way, in that I understood what was happening and the way that he presented it and the atmosphere and the acting and all of that added to it. It was a good version of that kind of story. So, yeah, I liked it a lot. We talked about the set design, which is just unbelievably good. And Florence Pugh's performance, which is also just really, really, really great. And I think she's wonderful. And even if this movie tanks at the box office and horror fans hate it, I hope it'll help her career.
Yeah, absolutely. I think she's great. And yeah, I like the movie quite a bit. You know, I don't know if I loved it, but I definitely liked it. And as I continue, you know, thinking about it, it's definitely building itself up for me more and more. One thing I found interesting, I found this morning. Did you hear about this Midsommar movie from 2003?
I have not.
So there was a movie in 2003 called Midsommar.
Spelled the same way?
Spelled the same way.
Okay.
Where a bunch of students go to a Swedish forest after one of their sister commits suicide. And then it was remade in 2008 by the director of the Blair Witch Project as a movie called Solstice.
Oh, weird.
Which is very, very weird. But, you know, obviously, Swedish forests are a creepy place to go deal with grief, I guess.
Well, yeah. I mean, and again, I feel like the concept of this movie is not something super original.
Right.
And obviously he was, you know, he was hired to make a movie with this concept. I think the fact that it's been in other movies is probably the point, in that some executive was like, oh, this is a reliable horror premise. Let's see if we can get our horror guy to do something with
Let's do an A24 version.
Yeah. 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 But maybe we should have seen those other movies and cited them as the puzzle pieces.
I just found out about it today.
Yeah.
So.
Come on, Dave, get on it. You got to do your background research.
Do my homework.
Yes.
All right. Well, Josh, you got anything else you saw recently you'd like to recommend?
Well, I was going to recommend something that you and I were actually going back and forth about on Twitter, which is the HBO series Room 104 from the Duplass brothers, which I think is sort of under the radar.
Yeah.
Especially for something from the Duplasses, who are pretty well known and well regarded. And it's an anthology series. So each episode is a different story. They're all set in this motel room and they span different genres from drama to comedy to horror to weird sci-fi. And because it's an anthology, they get a lot of really big name stars to show up for just one episode and do some random weird thing. And I'm still making my way through the second season, but I feel like this is a show that a lot of indie film kind of fans would really like. I mean, in addition to the Duplasses, there are a lot of indie directors and writers who work on this and then that they're kind of nurturing their careers.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, for whatever reason, I don't know if HBO under promotes it or there's just so much other stuff out there that it gets lost. But I think it's something that people should look out for. There's two full seasons, I think like 24 episodes, and they're short. They're almost all under 30 minutes, which I personally love. And well, you can watch them in any order. You don't have to remember what happened from episode to episode. So, Room 104, check it out.
I absolutely agree with that. And I've been really dying to watch season two. I love season one. And I've only watched the first episode of season two so far. But I mean, it's a great show. And yeah, I mean, it's such wide-ranging styles from episode to episode. I mean, some of the most like creepy horror to some of the best like dark comedy. I mean, it's great. It's a great show.
Yeah, it's a really good show. And I think I've watched 3 or 4 episodes of that second season. I'm certainly going to get through it all eventually, along with everything else I have to watch.
Awesome. Well, this episode comes out, you'll have something new to plug, won't you?
Yeah.
Although you've plugged it before on the show, but it's
new.
We'll
plug
it
again. It's finally being released, and people can listen to Awesome Movie Year, the podcast that I am co-hosting with comedian and filmmaker Jason Harris, and that Dave is producing and occasionally contributing his thoughts to. We are taking a look at a different year in movies in each season. We've just launched our first season looking at the movies of 1994. Each episode takes a look at a different film from that year in a variety of categories, including Best Picture, Biggest Box Office Hit, Biggest Flop, and a whole bunch of others. So we're very excited about it. Hopefully people who listen to Piecing It Together will give us a shot and will enjoy it. I think there's a lot of similarities. And if you like Piecing It Together, you will enjoy Awesome Movie Year, which is at awesomemovieyear.com and on social media things at Awesome Movie Year and Awesome Movie Pod.
There you go. And there will be a link in the show notes, and people definitely check out Awesome Movie Year. It's a great, great show. So Josh, that does it. We just did back-to-back Her Smell, Us, a 2019 midway through the year wrap-up, and now this movie. I know you've been on a whole lot lately,
yeah,
but we always love having you. So.
It's always great to be here. I hope to come back soon.
Hello, and welcome to Scream Scene,
the horror movie podcast where we watch every horror movie
ever made
in chronological order,
then rank them from best to worst.
Your dedicated hosts, Sarah
and Ben,
bring you a new episode each week,
covering the history of film through a horror lens.
From silent to sound and black and white to color, and the social and cultural context surrounding them,
Scream Scene is your well-researched, in-depth, and respectful dive into the horror movies of old.
Join us, creatures of the night, by subscribing to Scream Scene on iTunes.
And visit our website, screamscenepodcast.tumblr.com.
You'll be dying to subscribe.
That's pretty bad.
It'll be a hell of a good time.
Better?
It'll lift your spirits.
Okay.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that conversation about Midsommar. It is a crazy movie, and absolutely one that you should see in the theater if you haven't already. Although you really should have seen it before you listened to this episode, because I don't really remember what we spoiled, but we probably spoiled something that's pretty important. So, I mean, come on. You can't say I didn't blame you, but I am talking after the episode. What am I doing? What am I rambling on about? All right, let's just move on. Thank you, as always, for listening. If you're not already, you should be subscribed to Piecing It Together on your podcast app of choice. You can also rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. You can follow us on social media at Piecing Pod, and you can join our Facebook group, Popcorn and Puzzle Pieces, where we continue the conversation about all these great movies that we talk about on the show. If you really want to, you can also go check out our Patreon and become a Patreon. That would be pretty cool. We are starting to plan some special bonus content for that Patreon, but for now, you can get a whole bunch of my music if you sign up. So expect to see a lot more stuff there in the coming months. I'm going to start building that thing out quite a bit, but for now, there's not a lot there, but there is a whole lot of music, so check it out. And I do appreciate all the support in whatever way you have been supporting the show. So let's leave you guys with a piece of music, and then we'll be back with more Piecing It Together coming real soon. So what should we play for you guys today? All right, well, Midsommar is a pretty damn creepy experience, so I'm going to play a kind of creepy track of mine. I think I might have played it before, but it's a song called Scarecrow, and it's from my free album, Like Ashes. So if you do enjoy this track, you can go check out Like Ashes for free at davidrosen.bandcamp.com. So let's check out Scarecrow, and we'll be back with more Piecing It Together soon. We'll be right back.
and all points west.